session number 21564, wheel 5.
Ormac, wheel 5. You were saying it was difficult to actually get hold of accurate maps.
Well, they were good enough, but they weren't as accurate as they would be for the modern days. That occasionally led to the odd mistake. But they were just about adequate, and we had the river as the main guideline. But they were developed from old mapping, because nobody had ever thought to map the place after the war until this happened.
Did you have to do any mapping?
No. There was a survey element there, but
yes.
Clearly the Americans did a lot of that, and our survey people helped.
You mentioned having a liaison with the Americans, and it seems as if you were marrying up British and American equipment.
Yes.
Times. How did you get on with them?
They were most helpful, and obviously my impressions in that respect cover my whole experience in Korea, not just this particular time before, when I was in 5-5. But if we wanted things, we went down to the American engineers and said, look, we need a supply of blasting caps. They're detonators. You have to learn American terminology for some things. Mines, they supplied all our mines. We had virtually no British mines that I saw. There were, I think, the odd jumping personnel mine that we had, but they didn't last very long. We used American mines, American explosives, and American blasting caps for our detonators. The interesting thing was that we also used American Bailey Bridge, and that had been manufactured under license in the States, and the measurements were slightly different from ours. They were not necessarily compatible. So we also had a supply of American training manuals. They were available. And the liaison, I thought, was good, and that they were very helpful.
How was that carried out? Did you have an American officer attached to you, or did you have an LO attached to them, or did you just contact them?
Just contacted them. The relationship had been built up over a period of months, and we knew the chief engineer, at least my squadron commander knew the chief engineer personally from personal liaison when the thing was so fluid and mobile, and that there were personal contacts, and that's how it was built up. And they knew we were there, and they knew we were on their side, if you like. And as engineers, they were certainly very helpful, because they had all the main equipment. If we wanted heavy plant to begin with, we had to get it from the Americans. And they would send along a dozer with an operator. And they were excellent. They were very highly skilled operators. Most of our transport at the beginning was British, Bedfords. Then we had the little Bren gun carriers, they were called the Cambridge carriers, with trailers. The Bedford 1500 compressor truck I mentioned, water trucks were all the same size, all British. When the regiment came up, there was a gradual change to American equipment. When I got involved into a troop with 12 Squadron somewhat later, we quickly ditched our carriers after Operation Commander, which we can come to later, in favour of jeeps and trailers. The jeep was a wonderful vehicle. Then I had 2.5-ton GMC, and some of them were tipping vehicles, which were absolutely essential for the massive road and track construction program. If we wanted bigger tippers, the Diamond T4-ton tippers, an American tipper platoon would turn up and be attached to us for a particular operation. If we wanted graders, they would supply the motorized graders, certainly in the early days, because I think the regiment turned up with a couple of towed ones. They were the sort of ramshackle bone shaker ones. You know what I mean by a grader, I hope. It's for leveling the surface of the road, making it as even as possible. We used to operate in the early days on a British Bedford 3-ton truck, towing a steel girder behind us with two different lengths of cable onto it. And then you weighted that down with sandbags or other heavy weights, and then you graded your roads that way.
Shaving the ground.
Exactly, but it was very primitive compared to the motorized grader, which would then would do ditching as well, and cut a long ditch in no time at all. So they had the advantage of a greater supply of mechanical engineer equipment than we had.
Was there anything that we had that they needed?
At the risk of being facetious, I would say we had booze and they didn't. And that would get a lot of help very quickly, yes.
Now, Assistant Io, you said you wrote up the war diary. Presumably also you were dealing with information that...
Keeping a log.
Yeah. How much intelligence did you have about the enemy and their activities?
Pretty limited, really, at my level.
Yes.
Pretty limited.
But within the field squadron, I mean, presumably you were getting information about the overall situation coming down via brigade.
We had int sums,
yes,
sent out by brigade.
Yes.
Because that was that had 2-9 brigade, brigade group as it was. That was the black patch with a white circle, known colloquially as the frozen arsehole. They had taken over from 2-7 brigade, which had gone home by that time.
Yes.
They got in sums from, they sent from the Americans, because there was no division at that stage, and then they passed them down to us. And we kept map boards in the office truck mapped up, showing where our troops were, and approximately where Chinese or North Koreans might be, as much as we really needed to know at that stage. If anything developed in a big way, then we would be told double quick, either to go forward, go back, or whatever.
Did the squadron have any intelligence gathering role?
Not really. We occasionally sent people out on patrol to check up on mines and to confirm reports of mine laying, because that was very important. And from the sapper intelligence point of view, we did a lot of that. And also doing recces to assess the suitability of certain areas for tracks, or was the existing track any good? Yes, technical support like that to patrolling was done.
What did you do when you got back to the battle school? What was your role there?
Well, simply to... I was given an outline syllabus of what the assault pioneers had to do, and then as people came up from the reinforcement depot at Curie on their way, they came up and the assault pioneers all came to me. The mortar, yes, guys went to the mortar training wing. Then there was the medium machine gun wing. It was mostly these were the support weapon wings that we did, a signals wing, and then the rifle platoon, the rifle companies and platoons, they were put through range practice, and then there was a battle course that they had to go through.
Was this a sort of obstacle course with,
yes,
live firing?
It was live firing on fixed lines.
Yes.
And I would provide noises off by lobbing plastic explosive bombs around to give them an idea what it was like. And there were lots of coloured smoke and all the rest of it. The idea, I think, quite rightly, is to make sure that the battle school was probably as bad, if not worse, than anything they might experience otherwise, and therefore it would be slightly easier. So it was a very tough course, and we had a very experienced commandant up there, who was known as Mad Mike Lonsdale, DSO in the First World War and Second World War, that sort of thing. And it was deliberately designed to make people thoroughly fit, up and down hills, getting fit, getting thoroughly accustomed to the weapons that they were going to handle, particularly the support weapons, and generally getting them prepared to go and face whatever they were going to face up there. And then they had lectures from people, because all the instructors had been there. None of them had come straight to the school. They had to have experience there and tell them what it was all about.
What were the skills that the assault pioneers had to have?
Well, on a slightly basic level, very much what the sappers did. They were particularly interested in explosives.
Yes.
And they were particularly interested in mines and booby traps. Those were the two that I remember particularly, because there was so much mine laying going on there that the tactical minefields we laid, the major minefields, the protective minefields round company and platoon positions, we also laid, but where possible we used the assault pioneers to do those. They were basically just anti-personnel mines. They didn't have much of a role on anti-tank mines, and indeed there wasn't much use for anti-tank mines by that stage.
There isn't much good tank country in Korea, is
not
there?
And the North Koreans had lost most of their Russian tanks in the early days of the
yes.
war. The Chinese didn't bring forward tanks. We were never really threatened after that point by any massive armour threat.
And what about their own use of explosives? Were they trained in the demolition of wire obstacles and concrete emplacements?
The Chinese?
No, your assault pioneers. Was that part of their...
They did a little bit of that, but we also did field defences, of course.
Yes, digging positions.
Digging, wiring, the various kinds of wire obstacle they may have. And generally to make them, as near as possible, the battalion commander's own little group of sappers.
Yes.
The infantry battalions, or the British infantry battalions, all had an infantryman, a assault pioneer platoon commander, and he would have done the course at Haramura. He might also, if he was lucky, have done an assault pioneer platoon commander's course at the SME, because we ran courses for them in England. So if he was exceptionally lucky, he would have done that course.
He'd done two courses, and then
he knew what he was about. The Australians, the 3rd Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment, and I was much involved with them, their assault pioneer platoon commander was invariably a Royal Australian Engineer officer. Because they had no engineers in Korea. They merely had infantry and other supporting units, I think drivers, but they were mostly New Zealanders. They supplied infantry. So there was a grand chance for them to get some of their sappers experience, active service experience. So when I was with the Australians, I worked very closely with this guy, and I've got one chap coming on Monday who was an old friend of mine who was the assault pioneer commander there at that time.
How did you find the Australians to work with?
No problem. Once you got used to the fact that they had a somewhat reluctant idea of saluting, and they didn't really like to call you sir, but their approved greeting would be skipper. And I went along with that quite happily. As a Scotsman, which is a slight digression, I find it very much easier, because in those days my name was Jock, and Scotsmen had a 100-yard start over the others when it came to getting close to the Australians. And you were welcome with open arms, you were Jock and free and easy, up to a certain, and then when the soldiers from the ordinary guys started calling you a skipper, you knew you were home and dry. Their CO was a very, very good soldier called Frank Hassett, a very brave and distinguished man who finished up a lieutenant general, Sir Francis Hassett. Everyone called him sir. Everyone. Interesting. But we got along quite happily in that way. And
were they quick on the uptake, picking up pioneering?
They were very good, and they were very practical men, particularly those who came from country areas. And you notice the same with the Canadian sappers. They were very practical men, used to working with timber, of which we used a lot out there. Yes, we were very good at mine laying, explosives, we're bridge building we're very good at, and running water points. It took us a little time to get used to you improvise stuff, although we improved on that, and handling large numbers of mechanical engineering equipment. But we picked it up very quickly.
So would you say then there were really national differences when
yes.
it came to the talents of your various sappers who went, or infantry who went through your training school?
Oh yes, that's right. Yes, the Canadians had their own individual approach. The Australians were, and New Zealanders also. We had New Zealand engineers in when I went to 12 Field Squadron, we had a whole section of New Zealand engineers with one of their officers in charge, and a New Zealand sergeant. So at one time I had a troop with three British sections and a New Zealand section, and that was an entertaining experience. Very enterprising, very independent, but if you got them on your side, by whatever means, it's difficult to quantify, they would do anything. And a great deal of initiative, expert scroungers, and wonderful improvisers.
Sounds as though this was really rather like a miniature version of the Commonwealth Division.
It was, yes. The whole atmosphere of the division was permeated by that. And Jim Castles, our first divisional commander, was the ideal man for that. I mean, he encouraged it all the way down. All the parts of divisional headquarters were all mixed, Canadians and others, New Zealanders, all doing the same jobs. HQRE always had a Canadian G2 or SO2RE on the staff and so on. And we just got thoroughly used to working with each other. And it was a great experience and a great educational experience for both sides. It worked in both directions. And I think the Americans picked up something too. They developed, I think, a very healthy respect for British soldiers overall.
Were all these Commonwealth soldiers all volunteers, or were any of them national servicemen?
The Canadians were, I think, all volunteers, because there was some rule about national servicemen or not being allowed to serve out of Canada.
Yeah.
I think they had some restriction there. The Canadians were a mixture of volunteers, and then again, they had some reluctance about sending people overseas, but not less so than the Canadians, and I think the New Zealanders were all volunteers. We also had South Africans.
What were they doing?
They were mostly Air Force. They had a very good fighter squadron, I think. And I met some South Africans, and they were just a number of officers who came out, infantry and gunners mostly. Some did staff jobs, and some were attached to artillery regiments for experience. And they were as keen as mustard to do well. The Australians also had a squadron of RAAF, because the RAF weren't involved. The Fleet Air Arm was. And they were excellent.
Did you have direct liaison with the Royal Navy and with the Air Forces?
No, we didn't.
No.
There was the air control teams and so on, the liaison to get people in to give it close air support. There was all that set up, but at our level, no, we didn't.
What happened to you when you went back to the regiment? You went back, I think, to 12 Field
Squadron. I went to 12 Field Squadron. Mm. And then again, I did just a week or two as squadron IO proper that time, and I was in full charge of all that side of it.
How big was your intelligence section? Did you have a...
I think there was just myself and a clerk.
Yeah.
But I had the additional response, because at that stage, almost every unit had picked up a following of displaced Korean chaps.
Yes.
Five had a number of them. They were all ad hoc, and we gradually kitted them out. When I came to 12 Squadron, the thing was just getting organized, and all our chaps were shortly to be subsumed into the Korean Service Corps, which was being established. But we must have had about 150 Korean laborers, and one of my jobs as Squadron I was to pay them. That was quite an experience, and there were proper rules, all in Korean script, and they either had fingerprints or they had little stamps that they would stamp on, and the money was always new. I would go down to the field cashier's office and pick up a huge amount of Korean won, millions. It was an inflationary period, of course. The Japanese yen at that time was over 1,000 to the pound. The Korean won was about 10 times worse. So we had vast sums to pay out. That's how I knew all about them at that particular stage. And I had the back of a 1500 weight truck with a hurricane lamp swinging in the end, and they would all line up, and there was a chap in charge, a sort of unofficial NCO or a Korean chap there, who would interpreter, and they would come forward and get their pay. And they were almost all illiterate, but they could count that money in seconds flat. In spite of that, I finished up for a short time a Korean millionaire. I always had a bit left over, and I had a large box, a tin trunk full of this Korean won, which came in very handy when my Squadron 2IC at that time rang up and said, I'm a bit short on my imprest account. So I said, that's all right, I'll lend you $500,000.
You were able to make an adjustment.
It was a little bit chaotic like that.
What sort of work were these Korean labourers doing for you?
They did almost everything involving labour. And whether it was digging ditches before we got a decent supply of graders, they would dig ditches and I would make a template. And the chap in charge would give him this template and I would say, look, that's what we have to do all the way along. And he quickly picked the idea up. And that you had to do from there to there. And when you finished that, you could go. You know, that particular job. That was how it was done. It was, the judgment was, how much would they do?
Yes.
And we consistently underestimated how much they could do. They also did a lot of carrying. They would carry mines and wire up to various dumps. And they were particularly helpful to the infantry for their defensive positions. For wire and pickets and so on, and load carrying, ammunition, they would do anything, and they could, with their A-frames, which they all had, they could carry fairly substantial loads.
Do you have any idea of what sort of weight they could carry as a maximum load on an A-frame?
I wouldn't like to say, but it would be considerable, more than one would like to pick up. Yes, one was astonished at the beginning of their stamina and endurance. They were very tough men.
Who fed them?
At the beginning, we fed them, and then it became regularized when we had Korean liaison officers, and then we used to have one officer per squadron became worked with the liaison officer, and then he was the one who organized them, and then it was the money came from the field cashier. When the Korean Service Corps was formed properly, then all that was taken out of our hands, and they did that, and they had their own camps. But they were virtually attached to units, and then they were given more uniforms, better clothes, and their own rations.
Did they live with you in the field then?
Near us.
What sort of accommodation did they have? Were they in tentage?
Some tents, and yes, that sort of thing, and some hutches, which they would build themselves, and they were very good at that, because their houses, their village houses, were at that time fairly primitive.
You mentioned the uniform and so on. Did you find your own clothing, uniform, and boots and so forth, good for Korean conditions?
To start with, not really. It was all right in the summer. And I took out a pair of my own, those very popular Veltschuhn boots. Mm. They did not survive more than a year. They wore out. The first boots we had were the ordinary boots ammunition. Mm. Then we had battle dress. And as the winter approached, we were promised winter kit, which eventually came, but it was not really adequate at the beginning. I had a string vest, and I mean a string vest, and then khaki shirts, some khaki flannel, same as the soldiers, one of the early versions of the woolly pullover that had been developed for the airborne forces in the war, with a drawstring around the neck, that sort of thing, and greatcoats. And then it was during that second winter, that was 51-52, that the kit started to arrive. And then we had boots, cold, wet weather, with thick rubber soles, ridged and insoles, combat kit, which was green, and parkas came in, which were very good. And ours, in the end, were really quite good because they had a tail, which means you could sit down. Because the American ones were very good, but they didn't have that tail to start with. And when they sat down, they got rather cold on the bottom. But that was and then you could pull it up through here and fasten with studs.
Like the airborne smock.
Yeah, that sort of thing. It was really, it was very good when it came. And then we had sleeping bags eventually. of all colours, shapes and sizes. And we got very used to making ourselves comfortable with improvised stoves for heating up, and then we later got these petrol space heaters.
How did you improvise a stove?
With a 40-gallon oil drum, a 50-gallon oil drum, and you got your blacksmith to cut the end, one end off, and then you put a shelf in. It was rather like a simple field oven. And then you got some metal and old shell cases to make a chimney, and then you just burned the wood in there, and that threw out quite a lot of heat. There were various devices like that. And then we got the space heaters, which were petrol. They were drip-fed from a petrol thing, which were inherently terribly dangerous. But they were very effective at heating things up properly and quickly if they were properly used. But there were quite a few cases of people having severe burns and things.
I should ask you about whether you know, you suffered casualties due to the weather and the measures.
Mostly from trying to keep warm rather than from being cold. In the early days, I think the first winter, when they didn't have really anything in the way of winter clothes, there were some cases of frostbite, hands and feet. And it was incredibly cold, but I don't recall any of my troop having frostbite. We did the usual, you know, foot inspections and other things and so on, and made certain they had clean socks and all that sort of jazz. But as they all, each section had its unofficial Korean servant, there was no excuse for not having clean socks, as they did all the dobi. I started off at the very beginning with a British batman, but I quickly abandoned him to a field section, and I had a couple of Koreans, and they did all my washing and laundry, and if I had the occasion to use my field kit bath, which was a hole in the ground and the canvas tub, they would supply the hot water. So we were really quite well off in some ways in that respect. They were very good. Just a squirrel.
When you became OC of a troop, what sort of troop was it? Was it a standard field troop?
As it was in those days, slightly bigger. I think the scales, the manpower scales, were quite generous out there. Mm. Because it was a sapper's paradise, if you like. There was so much for us to do.
How many men did you have then in your first troop?
Well, when I had the New Zealand section, I must have had about 70 people. Because I can remember we had a role as infantry soldiers as well as sappers.
Yes.
And several times I was involved in that. And I was able to take out a rifle platoon of three sections of 10 men and a platoon headquarters, which was myself and my recce sergeant and a couple of chaps. That's about 35 people. I could take that out of the troop and still leave my troop sergeant in charge of a group of men who could do some viable work.
Yes. In effect, you could really form two platoons, couldn't you?
Almost. In an emergency, that would have been the case. And certainly, 5-5 independent at the Battle of the Imjin Battle, were really doing a hell of a lot of infantry work, basic work.
When you arrived fresh in this troop, did it take you any length of time to get to know them and get accepted and settle in, or were you taken?
I had
taken on immediately.
What happened was that I had a spell with a number two troop.
Yes,
with a very good friend of mine as troop commander. Then I went and took over one troop, which had the New Zealand section, and because the word gets round, he's probably all right, you know, that sort of thing. And then I got back to my old troop in the end.
Yes.
And that was easy because I knew them all and they knew me. And we had, I think, a very good working relationship.
I mean, I'm presuming there'd be men in these troops who'd be older than you and possibly more experienced in terms of having been in action. And
No. My troop recce sergeant was just a bit older. He was a very good combat engineer or field engineer.
Yes.
And my troop sergeant was quite experienced, and he was a good number. Very good.